I call the meeting of the February 25th, 2026 meeting of the House Public Safety Committee to order. A quorum is present. We do have a couple members to fill in that are in committee meetings that are delayed. Before we begin our meeting, I want to remind everyone that the committee chair maintains control of the hearing, and I have the following expectations. Signs and placards are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outburst, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Abuse or applause or other audible demonstrations will not be allowed. I will put my cheaters on. For safety reasons, standing or sitting in the walkways or alleys or standing or obstructing at your seat is prohibited. If you require accommodation, please speak with our sergeant staff identified by the gold ties. Troopers and house security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. If you received an entrance ticket, please retain it. It may be required for re-entry if you leave the room. Failure to comply with the guidelines will result in the removal from the hearing room. Thank you to the sergeant at arms who are present for helping maintain decorum in the committee room. Representative Steer, have you had a chance to review the minutes of the meeting from February 24th, 2026?
I have, and I move to approve the minutes.
Representative Steer moves to approve the February 24th, 2026 meetings. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion carries, and the minutes of the February 24th, 2026 meeting are approved. I see the Senate author of this bill has come over from their buildings and is joining us today. Welcome to the House Public Safety Committee, Senator Lang. Also with us is Representative Van Binsbergen, who will be presenting your bill. I believe I'm missing something. Am I missing a page? There we go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just stand by. First bill on the agenda is House File 2358. Representative Van Binsbergen, since you are not a member of the committee, I will move House File 2358 before the committee. And since the fiscal note came back with zero cost to the state, is a recommendation that is placed on the general register. Representative Van Binsbergen, please begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Novotny and members, the bill was brought to me by a constituent who suffered an unimaginable tragedy, personal tragedy in their home. Jamie Brenson's son, Carter, was 16 years old, and he died by suicide after he was sextorted online. As a parent, I can only imagine the pain and the suffering that Jamie has went through. And also as a parent, there's one thing we fight for and one thing we rally around is our children. And what took place is just, it's just unimaginable. I'll get into the details of the bill and its history and an amendment I would appreciate the committee entertaining. But first I'd like to turn it over to we have a couple testifiers here today, and one I think is Jamie's online by Zoom, and then we have one other testifier as well.
Thank you, Representative Van Binsbergen. I will have the staff bring up Jamie Bremseth, who is testifying via Zoom. When you're ready, please go ahead. Cannot hear you. Stand by. Try again, please. We're not getting anything. Still nothing.
jokes?
None I'm going to tell here.
Staying on till tomorrow, even if you're sick of it.
Is she the parent?
We can hear you on the laptop now.
Would you like me to get started?
I should be able to feed you through the mic.
Okay, just let me know when you're ready for me.
Let's try. Go ahead. Sorry, okay. I apologize for the technicalities here.
No worries, that's technology for you. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing my testimony today. As you know, my name is Jamie, and I live in Olivia, Minnesota, a rural part of central Minnesota. I'm married with three children. My oldest son, Carter, died 4 years ago on 12/5/21. My two younger kids are now 17 and 13. I am a mental health professional, and I work with children and adolescents in two rural school districts near where I live. I also work in a mental health crisis center. I interact with children and adults on a daily basis who are experiencing suicide ideation. On December 5th, 2021, my oldest son, Carter, died from suicide. After being unable to reach him and needing to talk to him, I ran home from my daughter's dance recital to find him laying on his bedroom floor. He had shot himself with his hunting rifle. To say I was in shock was an understatement. Carter did not experience depression or clinical anxiety like most people assume happens when somebody dies from suicide. He was honestly about the happiest kid you could imagine, to the point that he was a little annoying at times. He loved golf, he loved his family and friends, and he had really started to look forward to his future. The police conducted their investigation, and about 10 days after he died, we learned he had been the victim of sextortion. At the time, we didn't know what that even was. And what we found out was on 12/4, so Saturday, the day before he died, he was first contacted by somebody on Instagram claiming to be and posing to be a 16-year-old girl. He did not know this person. And they just, for that evening, they just kind of talked back and forth to each other about school, friends, typical like teenage stuff. Pretty innocent. At about 4 p.m. on Sunday, 12/5, was when the perpetrator first started asking for a nude picture. Carter originally told her no. He said he wasn't comfortable doing this. But this girl convinced him. She had been grooming him for this very moment the entire conversation. We learned through reading the conversation that it took less than 60 minutes from the time that he was first asked for the nude picture to when I found him at about 4:50 that afternoon. This person shamed him, telling him that she was going to send his picture to friends. He begged her not to, and followed her demands to send money. He originally sent her $200. When she started asking for more money is when he also learned from her that she sent his picture out, is when he first started talking about killing himself. To her credit, she told him not to, but instead she told him, just send me $50 more and it'll be okay. I read the entire conversation between him and the perpetrator once I received his phone back from law enforcement. The conversation started on Instagram, but she quickly moved it to Snapchat. I saw his fear, panic, and shame. She absolutely tortured him. He begged her to stop more than once, but she didn't. In the last 4 years, I have learned more than I could have ever imagined about sextortion and the perpetrators and the organized methods of targeting and preying on kids. I have spent hours of my time preparing material to educate adolescents and parents because I don't want this to happen to somebody else. I have traveled to multiple schools and community events to speak about Carter's story and to present on what to do if you find yourself in a situation that Carter did. The last event was just a couple of weeks ago, and I was invited to Alabama. I've met multiple groups of parents who have lost their sons to suicide because of sextortion. I believe that we are close to 45 boys from across the country who have lost their lives. And these are the children who have actually reported the crimes as sextortion. I know of at least one parent from Minnesota who has not been open about her son's reason behind his death like I have. Brandon Guffey, a state representative from South Carolina, is actually included in this group of parents. His son Gavin died as well. Our children are being targeted, tortured, and shamed online. As a mental health professional, I hear often about kids getting bullied online, usually by their peers. And because of that, I had had multiple conversations with Carter a year before he died, a year before this even came up, about the danger of the risks of bullying and coercion on social media, and kind of like what to do in those moments. And this still happened to him. Even though I had the wherewithal to try to educate him about it beforehand, my son still died. We live in a very greedy world, and technology has made situations so much more complicated and scary. When people don't seem real, it can feel much safer to interact and trust them. And I truly believe that is why Carter thought it was safe to interact with her, was because he didn't know her. We continue to work with the Minnesota BCA, who continues to investigate Carter's crime and case. His perpetrators are from Nigeria, but the same scenarios happen in our state every day. They do not all end in suicide, thank goodness. But kids especially do not deserve to be extorted, coerced, or otherwise tricked or blackmailed. People who knowingly target our most innocent and vulnerable populations need to face consequences that fit the devastating nature of their crimes. Carter is never coming back. I have had to accept this. I imagine that some of you are parents, and I challenge you to consider that reality that I have to face every single day. Somebody came into my home when I was home making dinner and targeted him, and he took his life. The heartache that he will never come back doesn't end for me. One of the ways we've chosen to move forward is to create a memorial foundation in his name to advocate for children and adolescents, which is why I'm kind of going around and speaking to people. I know that when we know better, we can do better, and we definitely want to do, our family wants to do our part in helping other people. Recently, we worked with the Star Tribune to share Carter's story in hopes to continue to spread awareness and education. The story was supposed to air or supposed to be published today, but they moved it to Sunday of this week. So it should be out here within a few days. They're publishing a story and a video, and I encourage you guys, if you're interested, to read it. You'll learn a lot more about sextortion than what I'm describing today. As parents, it is always our job first to educate and protect our kids, whether it's in person or online. But I hope as legislators, you will also do your part and holding people accountable who commit these crimes. Thank you for your time and attention to this matter.
Thank you for reaching out and being available and having to tell this obviously very painful story. Our next testifier will be Ashley Moore, Executive Director of Citizens Against Sex Trafficking. Ms. Moore, please take the witness testifier's table and state your full name for the record and begin your testimony.
Hello. Thank you, Chairperson and members of the committee. My name is Ashley Moore, and I'm the Executive Director of CAST, which stands for Citizens Against Sex Trafficking. Our mission at CAST is to empower our community to end sexual exploitation. And we define sexual exploitation as causing harm sexually for gain. Causing harm sexually for gain. Gain could be something tangible, something you hold in your hand like money. It could also be something intangible, like power, control, popularity, and acceptance. And we are happy to be able to speak here today to talk about this legislation because we see some good pieces to it that we want to advocate for. One, it provides stronger accountability for people who cause harm, physical harm, and death in order to gain something from them. And secondly, it advocates for public awareness, especially among our students. At CAS, our largest and fastest growing program is called Power Over Predators, or POP. It's a nationwide curriculum and teaches middle school, high school students, and community members online safety, healthy versus unhealthy relationships, and how to ask for help if you need it. For this program, one of the most clear pieces is that students do not understand the law. So we have a custom partnership with this nationwide curriculum so that we can add in Minnesota resources, statistics, and laws so that our students can understand how they're going to be impacted. Because we know that when we educate our students on these topics, and when we walk them through what the law states, we're not just preventing future victims, we're also preventing future offenders. We are seeing cases of sextortion start as young as third and fourth grade, and it's escalating by middle school, and it's becoming fairly common for high schoolers now to be facilitating this as well. We need them to understand what does the law state when we live in a culture that normalizes technology, glamorizes the hustle, getting ahead by whatever method, and treating that sense of body empowerment, taking a healthy message and using it to cause harm for gain. So when we go in and educate students, it's an invitation to understand that there's not only human consequences, but also legal consequences as well. And so we're so excited about this policy, especially on the public awareness campaign that gives this information to the students who need it so that they know how to ask for help. They know what their options are. They know how to say no and feel comfortable and confident. And they know that exploitation thrives in silence. And how do we talk about this in a way that brings healthy healing and advocating for the world we want to live in? Because it's not just what are we citizens against, it's what are we citizens for. And we are citizens for every person to live life to the fullest, free from somebody else trying to cause them harm for their gain. So thank you for your time and consideration on this policy. Happy to answer any questions and defer to leadership.
Are there any questions for the testifiers? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question, and thank you so much, Representative Binsbergen, for bringing this forward. I hope that I said your name correctly this time. I did not the other day.
Close.
I'm so close. I'm so close, Representative. Can you just clarify the reason to limit the increased penalties to Clause 6 of Subdivision 1, which is just the non-consensual dissemination of private sexual images as opposed to the rest of the coercion statute? I'm not sure if that made one of your testifiers, or
were you directing that question to Representative Pinto?
Well, if bill author or a testifier, I'm not sure if House Research can help. However,
House
you want to
Research
do it.
That can help with that.
Well, we've got an amendment to get to.
I'm sorry.
The testifier
okay.
This
I actually was.
Zoom,
I was reading it off, trying to read it off the amendment. But either way, Mr. Chair, we could do it after the amendment if you want to.
All right,
Mr. Chair, either
you.
Way.
Okay. Representative Van Binsbergen, I see you have a delete all coded DE1. Can you explain your amendment?
Sure.
Well, first of all, this bill was, Senator Lang carried this bill in the Senate, obviously, and Jamie testified last year, and the bill was to be included in the Senate Public Safety and Judiciary Omnibus Bill. During the conference committee, the conferees had Jamie testify to the bill there as well, and it's my understanding is that although the conference committee was interested in considering this bill and the omnibus bill, there was, you know, obviously some questions in regards to language and some concerns from the Sentencing Guideline Commission about the structure of the bill. So it's my belief it was worked on the interim, and during the interim, the language was restructured, verbiage was put in, and the result is a DE1 amendment that is before the committee today. So I appreciate if the chair could move that.
Representative Van Binbergen, I move your DE1 amendment. Okay. Are there any questions on the amendment? All in favor of adopting the DE1, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Motion carries and amendment is adopted. Back to Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so just wondering about, I'm really just curious, I guess, about the reason to limit it to that Clause 6. So basically, there's this underlying crime called coercion. You can violate it six different ways. What the bill does is increase the sentence if you violate it in the one way and results in great bodily harm or death. I assume maybe, I have a guess maybe is the reason, just you were very focused on the sextortion part of coercion, which is understandable, but just wondering if somebody were to do one of those other clauses. Just wondering about the thought behind that.
It's my understanding there was...
Representative Van Binsbergen.
Sorry. You know, there was some real bipartisan work done on the interim because there was some confusion and some of the language about proximate cause, and it was replaced with substantial factor in sectortions resulting in great bodily harm or death of the victim. So the amendment also separates great bodily harm and death into two separate clauses. Mm-hmm. So it increases the penalty if the result of sextortion is death. Finally, also, there was an effort to fully eliminate the cost of the original, part of the original bill was through the Department of Public Safety was a public awareness campaign, and so that's been deleted as well. So.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, no, and the changes in the amendment make sense to me, and maybe, you know, maybe something to consider in the future. No problem. I'll maybe just make the comment that, well, first, so grateful, especially to our testifier for sharing her story and her experience virtually. Really powerful. And that's just such a hard thing to do, and so I'm so grateful for that. And I guess I just wanted to take this occasion as an opportunity to say, like, this makes a lot of sense to me, this bill does. It's filling in a gap in our statutes. And I think sometimes we think about increasing penalties, or I feel sometimes I hear rhetoric about increasing penalties as a form of deterrence. You know, I, even with organized rings, I don't know that they're necessarily going to look at the statutes and say, oh, this is resulting in great bodily harm, therefore I'll get a 10-year penalty. Oh, I was going to do it, but now I won't. I just don't think that things work that way. That's not a reason not to support an increase in penalties. The reason that I support this is because that's just a basic foundational principle of our criminal justice system is if you do something wrong and it results in somebody dying, you should spend more time in prison than if it doesn't. It's just like that's not a deterrence thing. It's just like that's the structure of our system. So this is closing a gap. With a crime that's particularly heinous, and so I appreciate you doing it, and I think it makes a lot of sense. I want to make sure just to kind of lay out for some of the other bills we may consider that that's why at least I think this makes sense. Some other things may not if our argument is deterrence, but this is fitting in a structure and filling it in. So thank you for doing that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not even going to try. Thank you, Representative. I apologize. I'm going to get it, though. The one thing I wanted to comment on, in addition to everything that Representative Pinto said, was just the public awareness campaign aspect of things. I would really love to see that come back in the future because I honestly think that a lot of times, that especially when young people do this, it's more their brains aren't fully developed and they don't really understand what they're doing when they do it and the consequences that might occur. And it's, of course, incumbent upon every one of us who are parents to have that conversation with our kids. But you know, the reality is some parents are not comfortable having that conversation with them, and so I think a public awareness campaign would be especially important in this situation.
Go ahead.
Representative Van Binbergen or Senator Lang? You made the trip over.
First of all, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the invite. I truly appreciate that. It is, honestly, I wish I wasn't sitting here today. This one's hit pretty close to home. You know, same age as my boys, running in the same circles. This is something that I think, I hate to think of myself as an adult just yet, but at the older I get and the more the technology increases, and to be honest with you, you know, I'm a little ignorant to what kids are facing nowadays. And when this happened, we looked at statute, we looked at ways through the BCA, through local law enforcement, and how is this not only can, if you can find the perpetrator, which is a challenge unto itself, once we have, you know, new advances in technology where we can find these perpetrators, how do we prosecute them? And there was a large gap in statute. It was something where the state of Minnesota, in no fault of its own, just doesn't have that capability. My bill does not look like this yet. It still includes the public awareness campaign. I appreciate Ashley coming today and talking about where the rubber really meets the road on the public awareness campaign. They are already doing it. They have the expertise of far beyond what I think the state of Minnesota has on itself. We don't know how we're going to fund that just yet. We're going to figure that out. I think that at the end of the day, this bill may look a little different than the way it leaves this committee. It might look a little different than what I have. But we are, we're progressing, and I think this is a first good step. And thank you for taking it before the Senate did. This is a very bipartisan effort. Senator McQuaid and myself have worked on this for this will be the third year now. The language is as close as I've seen it, where everybody's giving a thumbs up. So very, very optimistic for me, and a big thank you for taking the time today.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Lane. Representative Hollins, were you done?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Van Binsbergen.
Perfect.
Got it? All right, that's all. Thank you.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you also to the testifiers here. Yes, we are supporting this bill today, and just maybe for the record, if nonpartisan, can describe substantial factor, or at least it's my understanding that that's used in other statutes, and just so we have that on the record, that language change that's in the DE amendment, and I do appreciate the work that went into this over the years, and especially in the interim to get it in this form.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, members, substantial factor is a term that's frequently used, particularly in the civil context, when talking about the relationship between a certain act and a certain harm that occurs. It means that it doesn't have to necessarily be the sole cause or the only cause to a form of harm, but it also can't be so remote that it's so attenuated that you wouldn't say that it actually caused the harm. It's not frequently used in criminal law, but it is frequently used in civil standards.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. That'd be all. I renew my motion that House File 2358, as amended, is placed on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Motion carries, and House File 2358, as amended, is referred to the general register. Thank you, Representative Van Binsbergen and Senator Lang, and to the testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 3496. Representative Harder, please come to the testifiers table with your testifiers. And I see that Deputy Commissioner Kahn is also on with her. Representative Harder moves House File 3496 before the committee. Representative Harder, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair Novotny and members, for hearing this bill today. I want to tell you how I got here with this bill, and then I will turn it over to my testifier. So as you're aware that we do a lot of reporting in the state, and there was a report that came out from the Department of Corrections. It's called the Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act, the 2026 legislative report. And in that report, there was stakeholder feedback. And within the stakeholder feedback, it came back from the stakeholders about addressing how outstanding restitution obligations are considered in supervision abatement decisions. And so from there, I'd had conversations about how we do the restitution. And along with that, there is this lengthy report, and it's called the Minnesota Statewide Probation and Supervised Release Outcomes. It's very lengthy, and I have a page within your packet to take a look at. And in that, of the cases that were closed in 2023, if you will notice that those that were paid in full, that it was only 35.8%. So there needs to be some work on that. And so I'm going to turn over to my testifier who has more information to share. Thank you.
Deputy Commissioner Khan.
Chair Novotny and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Safia Khan, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Corrections. I am grateful to be here to testify on House File 3496 today. I want to begin by thanking Representative Harder for bringing this bill forward. Restitution is deeply important to victims and to accountability, and it is clear that this proposal is rooted in making sure that the obligation is taken seriously. Raising this conversation is a great first step, and we appreciate Representative Harder's leadership in doing so. I would like to take a minute to just establish what supervision abatement is. Under the Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act, MRRA, passed in 2023, individuals subject to supervised release in Minnesota can earn credits by following their supervision case plan and, quote-unquote, staying out of trouble, that can be applied to reduce their time on active supervision. Even if someone is able to earn supervision abatement status and move to inactive supervision, their restitution obligations remain, and they can be pulled back on active supervision at any time if we, as the department, have concerns about their compliance or their behavior. As our legislatively mandated implementation report on MRRA reflected, as part of our policy development process, we received feedback from crime victim coalitions that restitution payments should be considered in supervision abatement decisions. At the same time, the same stakeholders emphasized the importance of some nuance and raised concerns that making full restitution payment a strict eligibility requirement could create inequities for individuals who don't have the financial means to pay. We, of course, defer to the legislature on the policy decision itself. Our perspective simply is that this bill starts a very important conversation, and we believe, and in our conversations with Representative Harder, that we can easily work with the representative as the author and with our victim coalition stakeholders to refine this language a little bit further and incorporate both accountability and a thoughtful evaluation of somebody's ability to pay. So with that, I'm here to answer any questions that you may have.
Questions for the testifiers or Representative Harder? Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Harder, for bringing this bill. I've appreciated the opportunities to talk about it, and I would love to work with you on it. Like I had mentioned, I have some concerns just about the ability of people who are incarcerated to pay full restitution, and if we're making it harder for them to get out, like, are we inadvertently making it harder for them to pay restitution? But I believe that it is so important to center victims in the MRRA process. And I know that's the intent, and I feel like there are ways that we could talk, like we had discussed around restorative restitution, ways for people who have caused harm to address that harm in a meaningful, important way, and incorporating that into MRA. So I look forward to, like, continuing our conversations and working with you and the DOC on this. Thank you.
Representative Harder, response?
Yes, thank you for that, Representative Feist. As we also discussed regarding this bill, is that the victims often are of lesser means, right? And because of whatever happened, they have things to pay for too, whether it's medical expenses, maybe they have property damage, or whatever the case might be. So it is important to work on this and to try and make these victims as whole as possible. Thank you.
Representative Mullen.
Okay. Oh.
Sorry. Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. I guess my question is for the testifier. So part of the agreement, plea agreement, the serve time, and their part of it is agreeing to pay the restitution, correct?
Representative, or Deputy Commissioner Kahn.
You know, Chair and Representative, that's a great question, and it might be one that some of the prosecutors in the room could answer better than I could. Just because we don't have as much input in the plea process, we take him after they have been sentenced.
Re-ask it, please.
Re-ask the question?
Yeah.
Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Chair Mueller, I'm asking a friend, isn't it part of the plea agreement as they go? I've also been told it's part of court order, but don't they sign off on it that they're going to pay the restitution? So actually, it's not being completed.
Representative Mueller, Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Whitty. So the restitution is typically set after the initial sentencing. There's usually like a restitution hearing, and it can be contested or not, and then it's ordered. So it's not always an agreement by the offender to pay a particular amount. I will say that one of the challenges, and it's been a number of years since I've looked at this issue, but one of the challenges that was in the past, and I assume is still the same, is figuring out what the offender's ability to pay is. There wasn't consistent forms. What judges across districts were looking at different factors or different things. And so there was a big effort to do a working group, a legislatively created working group. It's been about 10 years now, and Safia might have been involved with that. I was back when I was working for a nonprofit. But there was an effort to really change some of the processes just because it was so diverse around the state, and people were getting ordered for restitution that both that they couldn't afford to pay, and then the flip side of that was people that were having to pay restitution that could afford and weren't paying. So you were like looking at both sides of the coin. So that was a really long answer, but it's complicated.
Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Novotny, and thank you, Chair Mueller, for that.
Deputy Commissioner Kahn.
Chair Novotny, just for the committee's knowledge, you know, the bill itself is focused on the supervision abatement part of MIRA, so it would not apply to the folks who are currently incarcerated with us. And I do want to reflect, because we've had conversations with the representative, the DOC does collect restitution payments when folks are incarcerated. So we have many different means of collecting them. But for example, 10% of any money that is coming into the facility to the person, if the family or friends are sending them money, 10% of that will go towards their court-ordered payments. 10% of any money that the person is sending out will also go towards the restitution payments and other court-ordered payments. This has been a long-standing practice within DOC. Same with like 5% surcharge of anything that is spent on canteen. So we really do believe in restitution being an important part of that healing process for victims. And while folks are incarcerated, we do make sure that that collection is happening. However, based on, I think, kind of some of the discussion here, depending on how much the person is earning, spending, receiving, they might not actually fulfill their entire obligation before they are released onto supervision. I also say, you know, I think I was previously a victim advocate and worked in victim advocacy. So from that experience, I can also share that, you know, even beyond somebody's supervision term, the restitution obligation doesn't go away. It is not easy for victims to go and collect restitution through a civil process, but it is still an obligation that remains, and the courts are still an avenue that victims can engage in. However, you know, from my work, I can tell you that a lot of victims did not have the ability to go and follow that civil process afterwards. So we make sure in the department that as much as we can collect restitution while somebody is incarcerated with us.
Thank you for that. Co-Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Deputy Commissioner Kahn, I did have a question. When someone is getting ready for release, does the DOC try to help them with a payment plan with restitution?
Deputy Commissioner Kahn.
Chair Novotny and Chair Mueller, Another really good question. Yes, we do. So as part of their release plan, we do work on their court-obligated payments, and then, you know, when they go out in supervision, that is something that their agent would be reviewing and then working with them on. So I think as we think about refining the language of this specific bill and working with the author on it, we would be looking at, you know, possibly looking at how we determine if somebody is making that good faith payment. We know if they have a job or not. We know what their obligations are. We know if they're paying rent, how much they're paying rent, if they're in a halfway house, all of those different considerations, whether it's us or county supervision agents, they would have that information. So I think we can tweak this language and work with the bill author to make it something that is doable and takes into account kind of some of the concerns raised earlier.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, and like I said, that working group was really surprising to me when we got back some of the data and learned from many victims that the fact that somebody's making any sort of payment to their restitution, right, if they're on a payment plan and it's based on what their ability to pay is, just making those what they can can be very meaningful to victims because, you know, realistically, there are many offenders who aren't going to be able to pay in full the total amount. And so that is, you know, it really is important. But I do share the same concerns about this bill as being a have and have not situation, so that if somebody has a lot of money, you know, they're potentially able to pay and have the benefit of abatement versus somebody who really doesn't have the ability to pay off that full amount of restitution and then doesn't get the benefit of that, you know, and we're kind of seeing that a little bit at the federal level too. There's been pardons that have of white collar criminals, and it's hundreds of millions of dollars of restitution that's just wiped out as a result of that. And, you know, I'm sure there are people who are not getting pardoned who don't have that amount, that level of money. So I really appreciate Representative Harder's willingness to work on this. It is a really important issue, and I'm glad you're shining a light on the issue of restitution because it is very important to victims. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Harder, closing remarks.
I want to thank my testifier for coming today. I really appreciate your help. I want to thank the members here with your thoughtful questions what we had today and offline as well. And helping these victims is very important to me. I'm sure it is to everybody here to try to make them whole. And so I appreciate the work thus far, and we'll continue working on the bill. Thank you.
With that, House File 3496 is laid over. The next bill on our agenda is House File 3504. Representative Duran moves that House File 3504 come before the committee with a recommendation that is re-referred to Ways and Means. Since the fiscal note came back with a small cost, we will be laying this over. Representative Duran, begin your testimony.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Going to make sure the chair is okay. Run over there and save you real quick. You all right? Mr. Chair and committee, thank you very much for allowing me to speak on House File 3504 today. This has been brought to my attention multiple times within my career in law enforcement of having to try to protect the ones who are protecting those who protect us or who work on us. What this bill does, it actually adds medical security officers to the fourth degree assault statute. This has been an ongoing issue within our hospitals everywhere. There's been increased assaults on our hospital staff, and security is one of the frontline workers right there to protect those. A lot of the times, these assaults have been pushed to the wayside just because of there's no true penalty to hold these individuals accountable. So this bill is actually going to offer, more stricter penalty on assaulting a security officer in a hospital. But not only that, in your guys' packet, we're well aware of what happened not too long ago with an individual who got assaulted and died, a hospital security staff. So young person who got brutally assaulted and died just for doing her job. So this is bringing awareness to an issue we have in there, because we don't want our medical staff to have to go to work and worry about their safety. We want our medical staff to go into work and care for the people who need care. So an issue that we're coming about is hopefully we can come together and help protect those who protect us. I do have a
testifier.
There you go.
And it thank you, Representative Duran. It appears that we have Zoom set up, and sounds like our IT believe it'll work this time. The next testifier will be Donovan Michael Comer Hudkins, security guard. Mr. Hudkins, do you hear us?
Yes, I do. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you. State your name and begin your testimony.
My name is Donovan Michael Comer Hudkins. I live in northern Minnesota, and I work in a hospital in security. I'd like to start out by saying thank you to everyone for allowing me to be here and speak for a little while. I'm here to respectfully urge stronger statutory safeguards for hospital security who experience assaults while carrying out their responsibilities. Workplace violence has become more common in healthcare settings, especially in the emergency departments and behavioral health units. Hospital security officers play a vital role by addressing aggressive behavior, stepping in during assaults, calming individuals in crisis, and ensuring the safety of patients, visitors, and staff. Often we serve as initial responders before law enforcement get involved. This issue is neither isolated or limited in scope. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration reports that healthcare professionals encounter workplace violence at rates much higher than those observed in other fields. Data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics indicate that employees within healthcare and social assistance sectors represent nearly 75% of all national workplace violence injuries, and individuals are approximately four times more likely to sustain such injuries compared to the overall workforce. Hospital security personnel function within complex care environments, intervening with patients, visitors, and individuals in crisis, displaying violent behaviors. They protect nursing staff, delivering patient care, and safeguard physicians during medical procedures, maintaining order and emotional charge and potentially volatile circumstances. Increasing penalties for assaulting hospital security staff would strongly demonstrate that violence in healthcare environments is unacceptable, and those who ensure safety deserve effective legal protection. This would aid both recruitment and retention, and personnel feel supported when the risk is acknowledged by the law, leading to higher morale and workforce stabilities. Such measures promote fairness, deterrence, and consistency by providing appropriate protections to individuals who stand between violent incidences and vulnerable patients. I ask that you carefully consider the available data and real challenges within healthcare facilities and the critical need for safeguarding those who protect others. Thank you for your attention and your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Comer Hudkins. Questions for Representative Duran or his testifier? Representative Engen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill forward. It's crucial. Our family got to know the security officers at Children's Hospital when we were there for a 75-day NICU stay, and hearing some of the stories of what they have to endure and what they have to go through, whether it's potential fentanyl exposure, assaults constantly, tracking down people who are trying to steal stuff out of our cars in the parking lot. That's what they go through on a day-to-day basis, and extending those same protections as we do others in similar fields, I think that's a no-brainer. So thank you.
Representative Duran. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may actually just be a technical definitions question, and I support the bill and adding this. My question is, and it's maybe for you, maybe for a nonpartisan staff, but I know that security guard is defined in statute, but I don't know if security officer is, and if you intend, if you intended to be security officer or if it may be useful to just use the definition already instead.
Go to nonpartisan.
Okay.
Clarify that.
Representative Pinto with phone a friend.
No, I was just trying to get on the list. I'll gladly hand it to our experts, Mr. Chair.
On the list. All right. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenman, there is no definition of security officer that applies to this particular section. When a term's not defined, it would be given its common and understood meaning if it was challenged in a court. So it would have to be interpreted as whatever a commonly understood security officer would be. It would certainly be possible to change it to security guard and refer to a definition if that was the preference.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure where this bill is going. My good colleague, Representative Johnson, found the definition under 326.32 subdivision 13. If you are interested, I mean, it may just be helpful to put for clarity. The term, just reading it, security guard is pretty broad. So I think it would cover definitely all the things we're talking about, but just a suggestion, it may be worth it to add that definition in. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinchel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think under current law, I think I've even charged cases like this, a security officer who's working in an emergency medical services unit would be covered under current law. Maybe I'll see if Mr. Johnson would agree with that.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, so for the emergency personnel provision, does not include a security officer. I'm looking at the rest of the fourth degree assault, and I don't believe there's a separate one that would apply. Now, Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, I don't believe that this would specifically apply to a security officer. It would have to be under this particular provision. It's the fire department, the emergency medical services personnel unit, or a physician, nurse, or other person providing health care services. Obviously, if the security person qualified as providing health care services in some way, it would apply, but I don't believe there's something specifically calling out a guard or a security officer.
Okay. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and I'm now realizing I think I'm misreading that. It makes sense to me. Well, of course, we want to do all we can to protect medical settings in general, and then protecting the people who are themselves protecting medical settings. They absolutely deserve protection. I guess what troubles me a little bit here, Representative Duran, is this would be extending not just to security officers in hospital emergency departments, but to security officers providing protection to any medical setting. And I guess that makes me wonder, would you then want to extend to anybody working in one of those medical settings? I mean, if it's a higher penalty to assault a security officer at a medical clinic, I don't know why it wouldn't be a higher penalty to assault a physician or nurse working in a medical setting, which your bill doesn't cover. And I think what just sort of concerns me about these kinds of bills is figuring out where we draw the line, because once we start adding groups, you just can start adding almost everybody until there's only until there's hardly anybody left who gets the lower protection. Now suddenly we're sort of increasing penalties everywhere as opposed to making distinctions. I hope what I'm saying is making sense, but I'm just curious to you, like, would you support then extending to other people working in medical settings, and how far does this go? While obviously we want to do as much protection as we can.
Representative Duran.
the purpose for this bill is because these guys are actually put in situations where not all, I guess, medical personnel are actually put in. So if you're sitting behind a desk, you're not necessarily going to be dealing with the same people that the security guards are going to be dealing with, right? So, and then a lot of the times, obviously nursing staff and hospital staffs are nursing and doctors and everybody are also included in this, right? So it's the people that are actually dealing with some of these individuals on a regular basis that would actually be, I guess, added more security for, just because they are in that situation. They are in that threatful situation more often than, I guess, just everybody within the hospital. So these we're targeting this this general population, I guess, within inside the hospital setting, just because they are in that serious situation a lot more than all the rest of the, I guess, hospital staff.
And maybe just one final thing, Mr. Chair.
Pinto.
Thank you. I will note the way it's written is it wouldn't just be a hospital. It'd be any. It says hospital or clinic, which I guess I would interpret to be sort of any medical setting. Again, it may be that we say, you know, if you assault just a random person, that should be a lesser penalty than if you assault somebody providing security in a medical clinic. I could imagine that. But just thinking about where we draw the line, I guess that's the thing. My understanding is this is, I believe it's going to be laid over, but it may be worthy of continued conversation about exactly where we want to draw the line. Because it's, I just find with these assault in the fourth degree, increasing penalties, you suddenly start pulling more and more and more people in, and then suddenly just the penalties have gone up without actually having that distinguishing that we probably wanted in the first place. So anyway, but thank you for the conversation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Pinto, absolutely, I'm willing to work with you just to make sure that this bill gets through, absolutely. Any advice, we can or narrow this down or expand it to what makes people comfortable, but as long as we take care of the people who are taking care of those who take care of us, if that makes sense. Yep. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're good. Representative Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Duran, for bringing this bill and for the conversation we had. I am supportive of it. And similar to what Representative Pinto said with these assault statutes, it feels like every year you've been in the legislature, there's another bill to add another person or another category of people. And I am making this plea to my colleagues because this is my last year here. Somebody over the interim, please work on revising the assault statute in a way that we don't have to keep coming back and adding in more professions. Maybe it's an enhancement if you're in a position that makes you vulnerable because of your job or something like that. But until that happens, I think this makes a lot of sense. So just wanted to say thanks.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. Representative Pinto, I would just like to point out, and we've got the article about the young lady that was killed recently in Wyoming, and then I think about the times I've been in the hospital with a person that was in custody or in crisis, and not once did I call the HVAC guy to help me. And when, this assault, from what I understood, took place out in the parking lot, I'll say her name, Andrea Merrill. She went out to do the best to protect this person that was in crisis, and she died because of that. And like I said, the maintenance guy wasn't out there. Representative Duran, closing comments.
Thanks for the conversations, and we're willing to work with anybody to make it better. So thank you.
Thank you. With that, House File 3504 is laid over. Thank you, Representative Duran, and your testifier. Next bill on the agenda is House File 2169. Representative Schwartz, please come to the table with your testifier. Representative Schwartz moves House File 2169 before the committee with a recommendation. The bill is placed on the general register. Representative Schwartz, I believe you have an author's amendment coded A1 that updates the effective dates of your bill. Is that correct?
Thank you, Chair Novotny. I would like to move House File 2169 before the committee. Please bear with me. I lost my voice, so I'm going to try to get through this.
Well, so I'll do it for you then, okay. Representative Schwartz. The amendment simply changes the effective date from 2025 and inserts 2026. Does anyone have any questions on the amendment?
Thank you.
Representative Schwartz moves the adoption of the A1 amendment. All favors signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Motion carries and the amendment is adopted. Representative Schwartz, as briefly as you can, identify your bill and introduce your testifier.
Okay. So in 2021, the legislature passed a law recognizing orders of protection and similar orders issued by the court in Canada. The law authored in-house by Public Safety Co-Chair Rep. Kelly Miller was titled Uniform Recognition and Enforcement of Canada Orders for Protection Act. Senator Minority Leader Mark Johnson carried the bill in the Senate. He described the law as a protective shield for victims of domestic violence, which does not stop at international borders. Canada Orders for Protection now have the same effect as an order issued in Minnesota and any other state. However, there is a gap in Minnesota homicide statutes. Under the current law, it is a second degree in unintentional murders to cause the death of a person when an order of protection is in effect. The clause specifically mentions orders from Minnesota and other states, but does not include Canada. House File 2169 adds that recognition of order protection from Canada, tribal lands, the District of Columbia, and other U.S. territories to the second degree of unintentional murder statute. Violence-free Minnesota has indicated they supported this bill because it fits their goal in standardizing orders of protection language throughout the statutes. With me today to talk further about this bill is Liz Richards, Victim Services Director of Department of Corrections, former Executive Director of Violence Free Minnesota, and a longtime domestic violence advocate.
Thank you, and I see your testifier is Liz Richard of the Department of Corrections Victims Services Director. Can you state your name and begin your testimony?
Mr. Chair. My name is Liz Richards. I'm the Director of Victim Services and Restorative Justice for the Minnesota Department of Corrections. And actually, I'm not necessarily here to testify, but I am here to answer any questions that might arise. One of my areas that I've worked on for most of my career is protective orders. So if there's some questions specific to the bill, I'm here to answer questions.
Thank you. Questions for the testifiers, and hopefully not a lot for Representative Schwartz. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, maybe I'm too timid in my finger waving. My question is, because I went to law school in the United States, so I don't know what protective orders look like in Canada, and I'm wondering, are they directly comparable, or are they worded differently? Is there a way, like, do we have an apples-to-apples comparison that we can make when looking at that, or is it more complicated?
Well, Victim Services Director Richards.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, while I can't speak directly to Canadian orders, what I can speak to is under the Violence Against Women Act, which has been in place for many years, they have full faith and credit language that applies to protective orders. And that covers orders issued by any state or any tribal jurisdiction or any U.S. territory. And we already know that those orders are not necessarily exactly the same in those jurisdictions, but they're still afforded full faith and credit as long as they were validly issued. And there are various provisions about what makes it a valid order. And the same is true for Canadian orders that come out of there's a similarity between these various protective orders. I wouldn't say that it's the exact, it does not look exactly the same as necessarily a Minnesota state court order.
Representative Hollins.
No, that's really helpful. Thank you. I am just, so I'm thinking about, you know, the different orders that you might get here, and I just want to make sure that we're using the correct ones, but it sounds like there's precedent for this, so I'm going to say great.
Any other questions? I know, Chair Moeller, you've done a lot of work on very similar issues in the past with Canada, so you would be my bona friend.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's funny answering these questions today, but I was, and I think Representative Schwartz was referencing the bill that Senator Johnson and I worked on, and that was a Uniform Law Commission proposal to make sure that that we are recognizing Canadian orders for protections, and I don't know how we must have just missed this particular statute that it was in, or maybe, you know, I don't know if an offense happened and somebody realized it wasn't covered, but it was a Uniform Law Commission proposal. So hopefully, Representative Hollins, that gives you some comfort as well.
Representative Schwartz, closing remarks.
Thank you, members. House File 216 is a simple but necessary fix to Minnesota law. This legislation already has passed and recognized orders of protection issued in Canada, tribal courts in District of Columbia, and U.S. territories. These orders are enforceable in Minnesota and intended to protect victims no matter where they cross the border. This bill does not create new penalties. It does not expand criminal law beyond intent. It simply ensures that recognized orders of protections are treated the same under Minnesota statutes. Victims who come to Minnesota with valid protection orders deserve the same protection under our law. A protective order should not lose its full legal meaning simply because it's issued across the border. This bill is a technical correction that strengthens the existing law and closes a loophole. For those reasons, I ask you guys to support House File 2169. Thank you.
With that, I renew Representative Schwartz's motion that House File 2169, as amended, is placed on the general register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Motion carries and House File 2169, as amended, is re-referred to the general registry. Last bill on the agenda today is House File 3440. Representative Steer, please come to the testifier table. Since your bill simply clarifies the availability of an appropriation that was included in last, in this committee's omnibus last year, and doesn't spend any new money, you can move your money, you can move your bill to the general register. Representative Steer, is that your motion?
That is my motion.
Could you explain your bill, please?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 3440 was approved last session. Use of force training money was established for those funds, and they were only available until 2026 per the bill language. The Office of Higher Education and Colleges are reporting that the rollout of applications may take longer than anticipated. I'm asking that this committee extend the time period for these funds until June 30th of 2027. Pretty straightforward. I can take any questions that you have.
I will state, start out by saying, Representative Steer, that we have been in several phone calls with higher ed and the post board working together to try to get an appropriate and approved plan, and there has been some delays in getting the language back and forth worked out. Are there any questions for the testifiers? Representative Mueller, Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Prepared to support the bill. Thank you.
With that, Representative Steer renews his motion that House File 3440 is re-referred to the general register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed signify by saying nay. Motion carries and House File 3440 is re-referred to the general register. The next meeting of the House Public Safety Committee is Tuesday, March 3rd, 2026. Chair Mueller will have the gavel. There is no further business before the committee today. This meeting is adjourned.